My name is Danny Zapata. I'm here to talk to you today about how we went from three-week releases to daily releases. I work on the Edge delivery team. It's one of the teams at Netflix. I tend to mix in different terminology, which may be internal to Netflix. So if I don't explain something properly, please feel free to flag me and stop me. First thing, get the slide moving. There we go. Okay, so Netflix, we stream TV and movie titles to over 1,000 consumer devices, including originals. We're in over 40 countries with over 48 million users. We're expanding to doing expansion into Europe later this year, France, Germany, and a few other countries. The latest Sandvine report tells us that we account for more than 34% of the peak downstream traffic. Our subscribers consume more than 1 billion hours of streaming content a month. And in the UK and Ireland, we're actually the second largest source of downstream traffic during peak hours. This is our Edge server. So basically, we rebranded our API server as an Edge server. It's a front door to the Netflix to Netflix for UI devices. Provides data such as list information, box art, search, account information, those kind of things. We allow our UI device developers to upload Ruby scripts instead of using a one-size-fits-all REST API. We allow these UI developers to upload Ruby scripts where they just talk to our backend services and get just the data they need for their devices. If you think about it in an MVC model, the scripts are kind of like dynamically controlled controllers, or dynamically compiled controllers. We connect those scripts to backend, what we call dependency services. As a result, we host over 500 client jars in our Edge server. We break our server into 8 logical Java modules, which results in a deployable war. We used to build with Ant and Ivy. I'll go into a little bit more about that later and why we changed. And for us, pushing to production means pushing a couple hundred servers to the cloud. We use Amazon AWS to deploy our services. This eye chart is our list of our dependency relationships. So I mentioned we have over 500 client jars, dependency and third-party jars. I don't expect you to, we're not obfuscating this on purpose. It's just that complex. We interact with these jar dependencies via internal installation of Artifactory. We don't use Maven Central because we want to isolate ourselves from instability, and we also want to host our own internal jars. Keeping these jars up to date and working together is one of the biggest obstacles when we look to push code more frequently to production, and it's actually one of the biggest time sinks for our team. So a little bit more about the Edge API server, or the Edge server. We have over 2 billion incoming requests per day. Those go to over 30 distinct backend services, which fan out to 14 billion outbound requests to those backend services. We provide data to over 1,000 different device types. As I mentioned, we deploy hundreds of cloud servers. When we do a production push, we usually get that done in under an hour. And you know, getting ready for this talk, I was looking back on how we used to do things three years ago, and it kind of feels like the Stone Age compared to where we are today. This is a look at how we used to manage our code. You can see we have three long-lived branches, prod, test, and dev. There's auto down merging. Prod is basically reflects the current state of production at any given time, plus any patches we want to put in right away. Most developers code on test or dev. releases to production would trigger a clobber merge from test to prod. Basically, what that does is makes the prod branch look exactly like it does in test at the point of release. Some of the issues we had with this approach, automation wasn't aware of anything besides these three branches, so developers wanted to code features, they couldn't send it over to our CI automation and get feedback. Down merges and perforce were separate commits. I should mention that we use perforce. Down merges were separate commits, so traceability between branches was difficult and sometimes manual. This clobber merge that I talked about was very destructive, and you had to manually verify that the automatic down merge was working before you did the clobber merge, otherwise you can lose features. Another quirk of perforce is that you can't reapply a reverted change list. So what happened was that the down merge would forget that I had, if I wanted to reapply a change list, it wouldn't automatically down merge it. And if you weren't aware of this, you'd also result in lost code. You couldn't make experimental changes to any of these three branches without affecting everybody else, since all developers were on one of these three. And as a result, we had a high occurrence of broken builds and an unstable pipeline. Let's see if, there we go. Okay, so talking a little bit about a production push process, our team had a rotating push lead duty. Basically, they were responsible for shepherding the build into production, following up and fixing any broken tests. We pushed every 3 weeks. We would, during a push, we'd spend at least a day in the device lab doing manual testing. We wanted to verify with our key devices that we didn't break any functionality with this push. We used a manual checklist to do that. The pushes themselves were manual via web UI. We actually open sourced that UI. It's called Asgard. Every push, you know, because we're pushing every 3 weeks, we had about 60 commits per push and over 200 jar changes. Compilation and testing tended to be flaky. Part of the reason for that is that our dependent services would fail, so it wasn't necessarily the new code that we were trying to test that was a problem. We'd also run into frequently timing out requests. We had a lot, because of these 3 week cycles, developers would try to push in a lot of last minute changes that simply couldn't wait for the next 3 week release. If there was a feature going out a week from now, they had to make that release. And the problem with those last minute changes is that we wound up with a lot of churn. We wound up having to do a build, test, fix cycle over and over again right at the end of the release, which was very painful. At the time, 3 years ago, we used to deploy to one AWS region, US East one. And as I mentioned before, production pushes took about an hour if there were no rollbacks. This is kind of a screenshot of our manual UI deployments. You can see that the gray box here is the previous production code that's disabled and no longer taking traffic. The middle box is the new code that we're pushing. So pushing and rollback were very much manual. You better hope that you click the right button, otherwise you can easily cause an outage. So the main thing that we looked at when we did pushes was what we called an SPS graph, so streams per second. So it was a near real-time graph where we would see how many streams were starting per second, and we had a predicted curve. And if we push and that graph took a dive, we knew there was something wrong with our push, and we had to revert quickly. So as a result, our pushing turned out to be a lot of finger crossing when we were pressing the buttons, and a lot of extreme pain when we had to roll back or figure out when things went wrong. And we were only pushing to one region at the time. Today we pushed to over three AWS regions and counting. So we felt like we were quickly becoming a bottleneck for other services for getting their features out, so we wanted to do something about it. We wanted to get good builds out quicker. Production pushes for us were very much a black box. We didn't have a lot of insight into them. And we knew that we were expanding into different countries, so we knew this process wasn't going to scale. So we decided to try different things to automate ourselves out of this painful release cycle. Just to kind of summarize some of the things that weren't working for us. I mentioned those over 500 dependency jars. Whenever a developer would pick up a new combination, there was a high chance that they would break. We had a very manual and painful release process. Our tests were flaky, not necessarily deterministic. We felt like our production pushes were very much a black box, which we didn't have a lot of insight into. And because developers coded on one of those three branches, every commit affected somebody. And we had long build times. At the time, we were doing about 45 build, compile, package times, in addition to another 45 minute of testing, smoke testing. So we started to tackle these things in different ways. One of the things we did is we implemented this concept of dependency locking and auto updating. So the idea is that developers, when they code off a stable version of the last calculated dependency graph. We have a separate process, a separate pipeline that goes through and recalculates the dependency graph every day, does a build, unit test, and smoke test against it, and only when those pass are those made available for developers to pick up. This is when we were using Ant and Ivy. In the top here, you can see that this is the templated version. This is what the auto-update process used with variable revision numbers, and developers would pick up the IV file, dependency file, with specific revision numbers, and that's how we kept them stable. We've since moved to Gradle, and dependencies are managed differently now. They're first-class citizen in Gradle versus Ant and Ivy, not just an add-on. They give us better control over our dependency graph. We're also able, as a result, be able to add better validation tooling around what we think our dependency graph should look like at the end, and we can break the build if those assumptions are not validated. We made a big investment into beefing up our testing. I can't emphasize enough how important having a good test signal is. It's good, reliable test and representative test signal is to being able to deploy more frequently. Some of the things we did to improve our automated testing, we reduced the variables. So we started using dependent services running in production. So the only variable when we're doing our testing is our actual new code. We invested a lot in hardening our tests, adding retries, adding better reporting. Generally, when the test fails, we have the test report would have a curl command with the exact command to reproduce it. We also introduced this concept of known test failure. So there was a low level of flaky tests. So instead of disabling them and forgetting about them, we would go ahead and mark them as known failures. And what that does is that it wouldn't block the pipeline if they happened to fail, and they would show up as a yellow step there. We invested a lot in having a truly representative smoke test suite, which runs very fast. Part of that is being able to parallelize the test. We made a big investment there. We also added a lot of tooling to make it easy for developers themselves to add tests. Excuse me. We eliminated that manual testing as a gate, so that day in the device lab, nobody liked it, nobody wanted to do it again. So we went ahead and inspected the REST calls that those devices were actually making, and we automated them into tests. We also did, we ran code coverage in production to see what parts of our code were actually being hit, and then we compared that to what we were testing and closed that gap. So we also added more insights and data. I talked about how our production pushes were a black box. We now have this dashboard. It's a real-time dashboard that tells us the status of our production fleet at any time. When things start to go wrong, we generally can detect them before the customer does. The two red circles there, that's stuff going badly. So the big red circle, the size of the circle indicates that that particular endpoint is taking a lot of traffic, and the red part of that is indicating that it's failing. We also added chat alerts, which was also a key part of it. So we used to do a lot of email alerts, and developers would learn to ignore those. So we started sending chat messages when things started going wrong to get a quicker developer response. So then we also implemented this process of a canary. So the idea was taken from the idiom of a canary in a coal mine. So coal miners used to use caged canaries to detect dangerous conditions before it would affect the coal miners themselves. So our automation process, our canary automation process, what it does is that it would spin up a small fleet of the new code and run that in production to see how it does taking actual production traffic. Typically, we run these canaries about 6 hours or at least through a peak traffic period. Initially, we only did this in one region, US East 1, but now we allow for multi-region canaries. This gives us a more representative example of how code will actually do in production when we deploy it to the entire fleet. One example where this would have been useful is that when we deployed to Latin America, we realized that PS2 is actually very predominant there. People would use PS2 to access Netflix. That's not the case in the US, so having a canary that can take that PS2 traffic and execute those other code paths would have been very, very valuable to us. So and along with the canary process, we would compare the metrics of the new code versus old code. We'd compare about 1,600 different metrics, and we'd use a scoring system out of 100 to determine whether or not a push was, or code was push-worthy. Generally anything over 90 we'd call push-worthy and go ahead and push into production. We had three canary clusters, so no more than three canaries could be running at any given time. and the Canary lifecycle is managed automatically. Very broken code, code that's serving a bunch of 4XX and 5XX would be taken out of service immediately, so we wouldn't wait those 6 hours. Next thing we did is we automated production pushes. So this is one of those terms I'm not sure is familiar outside of our company, but we have red-black pushes, basically. So red is the current code in production. We spin up a new black cluster with the new code, and then we go ahead and we switch the traffic over to the new code. This is all done in an automated fashion. If there's an error, something happens where the new code isn't working, we're able to quickly switch traffic back to the old code. Being able to do this rollback is, I think, absolutely essential to be able to push more frequently. If you're afraid of rolling back, if rolling back takes multiple hours, you're less likely to push more frequently. Rollback's generally 20 minutes max, I think, to get everything onto the old code again. So generally, everything went well during pushes, and we just delete the old cluster after a few hours and go on with our day. That was automated as well. So another improvement we made is that we went from Perforce to Stash. Stash is an enterprise Git for those of you who are not familiar. It adds pull requests, has a rich REST API, has enterprise authentication, and a nice web interface to Git. It's basically a competitor to GitHub, if you're familiar with GitHub. The reasons we liked it is that it's distributed. We were able to reduce the number of long-lived branches in favor of many small branches. We were able to add developer pipelines so developers can code in isolation and send up their code to the CI before it and build and test that and even canary that later on before it affected other users or other folks in the company. And we were able to implement automated pull request gates. I'll talk about that a little bit later. We found in general, Stash syncing was a lot faster versus Perforce. We got better merging. We found less merge conflicts. And it also allowed us to work disconnected. Perforce, to basically do just about anything, you need to be connected to the server. That's not the case with Stash. So we worked on improving our build time. So initially I mentioned we were doing 45-minute builds with Ant and Ivy. We did invest in trying to make Ant and Ivy faster. We were able to get that down to about 18 minutes. We optimized that by taking those 8 modules and actually consolidating them into 4 Ivy files. So the big performance gain was basically resolving 4 Ivy files versus 8. But we wanted more. We wanted to go faster. So in general, just switching over to Gradle was simply faster. It got our build times down to around 6 minutes. Speeding up the build times allowed us to iterate quickly when things went wrong. We were able to better service our internal customers because we can turn around features quicker. And a nice side effect is we also found that developers were more likely to run our smoke tests because the build and unit test cycle was a lot quicker. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our automated build pipeline. So say the developer wants to start a work on feature. They would go ahead and create a developer branch off of master. They'd go and make their changes. They'd open a pull request when they felt their code was ready to be reflected on master. At that point, Jenkins would take over and recognize that there was a pull request against master. It would automatically do the compile, unit test, and packaging. If that was successful, at this point, the pull request is merged. If not, the pull request is rejected. Then the pipeline continues on to patch a CI server with the new code. We'd go ahead and run the smoke tests against that. And if those smoke tests are successful, we'd push the internal environments and optionally push a canary at that point. And then the canary analysis would take over, and we'd also run what we call the squeeze test. So we want to make sure that any new code going into production was as performant or better than the existing code. And the squeeze test allowed us to drive a lot of traffic over to those new instances to see where the breaking point is. If those metrics were good, we'd go ahead and push to production, and that's when users would see the new code or get the new features. So this is our main pipeline, but we use pieces of this to enable our developer pipeline. Developers can actually test and canary their code in isolation outside of the main branch and canary it without affecting other folks. So they can get feedback. Let's say you're working on a long-running project, you can get some feedback iteratively before you're ready to merge into the main line. So we also expanded on this idea of the canaries. So before, we were doing 3 canary clusters. We recently expanded that to a scalable canary solution. This allows any developer to spin up a canary at any time without waiting in the queue. When we were limited to 3, there were sometimes we had queuing issues. And our dependent services, they were also able to leverage this canary automation so they can test their pre-release code. So the idea is that we take existing code that's running in production, we go ahead and swap out their jars for a pre-release version and run the same canary process. They're able to get feedback on that before they release their jars. And another enhancement that we made was that dependency pipeline automation, we were able to actually bring the concept of canaries into that as well. So developers only see the new dependency jar graph when code is not only built, unit test, and smoke test, but now also has to survive a canary with a good score. So having insights into our dashboard, or having insights into our code, was also important. So we created a dashboard for our build and push insights. This is where we can also schedule pushes and rollbacks if needed. It aggregates a lot of data that you would have to go to different places to find. For example, it'll list the code. You can go and find the code differences between one production push to another, as well as all the jar differences. If smoke tests start failing, I can look at the smoke test history and pinpoint the specific commit to where the smoke test started failing. I feel if you can aggregate these things, all these data points together, you're a lot more informed when you're making push decisions. Putting all these tools together, it's automation and reliable testing, really helped us move quicker, move from those 3-week release cycles. So I took a quote off the continuous delivery book. I assume some of you have read that. But in software, when something is painful, the way to reduce the pain is to do it more frequently, not less. So we really took this to heart. We went from 3-week release cycles 3 years ago to 1-week cycles to now we push every day. Having less commits helped us narrow down the scope of the push. So when something did go wrong, we were able to look at a smaller set of commits and smaller set of variables. When we need to roll back, also, we're rolling back just the day's worth of changes versus a whole 3 weeks worth of changes that we may need. It also, we found they really reduced the need for last minute changes. So developers didn't have to, they knew that they wouldn't have to wait for 3 weeks to get their feature out. If it didn't make it in today's push, you can make it in tomorrow's push. And again, I'm going to emphasize quality here. You absolutely have to have a good testing and a reliable signal of quality to be able to do this. Otherwise, you're going to be frequently rolling back. We also use the concept of feature flags, where developers can enable and disable features in production without actually doing a code push. So that kind of gave us, developers are able to push these things into production, and if they weren't working out, they can simply just flip a switch, which would turn it off within about 60 to 90 seconds. So in summary, I'm going to talk about, summarize kind of what we talked about and all the different things we did. We did dependency locking. We now have a reliable representative test signal. We have better insights into our code. That's the real-time graphs that I showed you earlier. We implemented this canary process before the production push. We made a big investment into automating pushes, and that's from code check-in all the way to production. We added the ability to roll back quickly. We spent some time optimizing our SCM and build tooling. And of course, that pipeline I mentioned earlier. And this dashboard to kind of aggregate all the data. So not everything worked well for us. It wasn't all wins. Initially when we started looking to move quicker, we used Sonar to try to aggregate all the data we needed to get insights into our code. We quickly found that wasn't able to correlate the data as well as we wanted to, so that's why we moved to our own dashboard. While production coverage did give us a really good boost initially in closing the testing gap, I think there are diminishing returns over time. We still run them occasionally, but not as much as we used to. We still have some downmerge issues with the dependency locking because we have that giant graph. We frequently run into merge issues. We mitigated some of that with some tooling. And when something's broken, developers would get email. They get blasted with emails and IMs, and I think initially that led to a lot of alert fatigue, so we had to tune those over time to make sure that developers were just getting the information they needed to act on. So some of the things we're looking at, we want to continuously improve. So some of the things that we're looking at to in the next phase is using something like the Git bisect tool to help us narrow down when bad code is introduced. We'd be able to, when we get a bad canary score, use Git bisect to spin up canaries with a subset of those changes until we find the one that caused the bad score. With our dashboard right now, we're doing Jenkins. We pull Jenkins a lot, and we keep expanding our dashboard to support more pipelines. This is loading Jenkins up a lot, so we want to look forward to being more efficient with that. One of the things we can do is instead of us pulling the dashboard pulling Jenkins, have the Jenkins build report back when things aren't working, or report back good or bad builds. We want to iterate on this dependency management automation. Right now, we've made a lot of strides there, but when developers have to add a new dependency, that's still a fairly manual process where they have to know which files to commit to. And we're looking to productize these things more across the company and via open sourcing. Because of Netflix's freedom and responsibility culture, we don't prescribe these solutions to other teams. Other teams are free to choose development and push automation which works best for them. So not everything that we do will work for every team. We encourage them to take the pieces that work for them best and roll with it. So just a few links. We opened that Asgard web UI that I showed earlier. That's part of Netflix open source. There's a bunch of really useful tools there. Gradle, I would definitely check it out if you haven't. In short, Gradle's kind of the intersection of Maven and Ant. It allows configuration and convention and really gave us a big boost. And Netflix recently open sourced our Gradle contributions. We have a bunch of plugins, including that dependency locking plugin. We have stuff for interacting with Stash and dealing with pull requests and some of the project conventions we use. And of course, if this stuff seems interesting to you, please come talk to me. We're always hiring, or go to our jobs page. Thank you.
Hi, nice presentation. I was just wondering, so you mentioned that you made it easier for your developers to create tests. Could you kind of expand on that a little bit, or maybe not?
Yeah, so basically we wrapped JUnit and TestNG base classes, added more conventions around that. We added a scaffolding to make it easy for them to write request response-based testing. We inspect the results. We have certain headers that we respond that our dependencies return back when we're testing, and we added automation to inspect those so we know when it's an error with our code or if it's an error with a downstream dependency, and we can make the test decisions based on that.
Yeah, one thing I've always found in terms of changing build tools and all of that is you get a lot of the initial reaction from the developer community is usually not positive. And I'm wondering how was your experience in going from Ant to Gradle? That basically did.
Well, I think Ant was very painful for everyone, so we were ready. It was we reached a tipping point where builds were just simply taking too long and unreliable, so they were actually asking for something better. And that's when we started evaluating Gradle. We also used it for our test framework first and kind of vetted things there and wrote some scaffolding around there. And so they were we kind of led them into it, said, okay, well, when you're running smoke tests, use this Gradle command. And that got them comfortable with it. And then when we made the switch, just having those performance gains made everybody really happy to use Gradle. And in general, Gradle's, when you write Gradle scripts, they're code, which is also a lot more familiar to developers versus XML files.
Hey, how do you deal with the incompatible changes coming down the pipe? So API changes or any other changes where you can't actively have a canary or need to stage things fleet-wide before they're turned on?
We generally don't run into those kind of issues. We use feature flags to kind of control. We can also, we have access to our proxy server also. We can direct traffic to a debug cluster and do things there. We can do a lot of interesting things with automation, but generally we don't. We've really taken the model of pushing forward. So we consolidated our mainline to just that one master branch in favor of a bunch of feature branches. We can also let things bake internally. I'll let other teams use our new code without affecting customers. We connect devices physically to those internal test environments and do a lot of vetting there if we needed to.
Is the process different for end-user software that you push down to devices as opposed to what you're saying about servers?
Yeah, each device releases differently. We have a team of internal Netflix UI developers that develop for some devices, but largely we do a lot of partnerships. So we have a Netflix SDK, which companies like Samsung would code to and have that Netflix experience. So I'm not too familiar with how UI pushes are managed, because they're all, we're talking about over 1,000 devices, and I'm sure every manufacturer works a little bit differently. I know we have a certification process when new builds come out, but I'm not too familiar with it.
You mentioned Artifactory for like half a second in there. Can you expand a little bit more about how we're utilizing that?
So when I started doing SEM type stuff, 14 years ago, we would check jars directly into source control, which we all know is a bad habit now. Artifactory basically allows us to host those in a central place where developers can go pull them down. We host our own internal builds and jars there, and then we also pull down third-party jars and host them there. So we're able to tightly manage that, and if some jar gets introduced in the wild, let's say on Maven Central that we don't want to pick up, we can also manage that and mitigate that before it reaches our internal server. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it's basically what I thought.
Okay. Yeah.
Are you only proxying to certain repositories like Maven Central and Google Code, or do you pretty much through Artifactory allow access to any Artifact repository out there?
It's not a full pass-through. Actually, Gareth probably knows a little better about it than me, but we do allow mirroring for some things like Gradle plugin tooling gets a more open repository than stuff that goes out into production.
For the most cases,